beating in the heart of my life is an awareness of how much of life and the important things of life are just ordinary miracles, ineffable experiences of wonder, profound moments where we are touched as individuals and connected to each other and to the universe. I take and have taken from my youth the poetry of religion very seriously without ever having taken it literally. To me, the poetry of religion is art. It is as all poetry. It conveys an experience. No one asks me whether I take a Picasso or a Rembrandt literally, only if I get something and moved by it. To me, the poetry of religion at its best, and sometimes even at its worst, is the words are only the musical notes of the composer, the brush strokes of the painter. They convey something about how we are in the world when we stop and we're willing to be touched by the world and informed by the poetry. I'm going to discuss a little bit three things that touched me in my youth and that are still sources of some inspiration and really nourishment. And some of them, I'm going to warn you in the beginning, may seem cornball to you in the beginning, in the middle, and maybe even at the end, but they touched me and they continue to. The first one, I was very young in 1954 when the song I Believe came out. And I'm going to look at the words because I want to convey them accurately. I believe for every drop of rain that falls, a flower grows. I believe that somewhere in the darkest night, a candle glows. I believe for everyone who goes astray, someone will come to show the way. I believe. I believe above the storm, the smallest prayer can still be heard. I believe that someone in the great somewhere hears every word. Every time I hear a newborn baby cry or touch a leaf or see the sky, then I know why I believe. Now, I don't have to take any of that literally. I don't have to believe in an anthropomorphic someone in a great somewhere hearing every word. It's fine for people who do, and it would be fine if I did. But my 10-year-old person didn't need that. My 10-year-old person was wrestling with the issue of understanding my relationship to nature and my relationship to life. The phrase that got me was every time I hear a newborn baby cry or touch a leaf or see the sky. Now, it doesn't happen to me every time I hear a newborn baby cry. Sometimes it reduces me to tears and annoyance. But touch a leaf, see the sky. The miracle of life, the miracle of existence, the miracle of just being here is overwhelming and ineffably grand and fine. We often don't stop to hear, to listen, to look inside and outside, to open ourselves up to the poetry of existence, the sheer glory, I'm going to use another religious word, the sheer glory of existence. And it doesn't need a theology. Thanksgiving doesn't need a theology. Prayer doesn't even need a theology. Sometimes when I pray, and I'm not talking about the trivial things like where golf balls land or the outcome of a sports event, but when I really pray, it tells me about what I believe, what I care about, what my priorities are. When I'm walking with a newborn baby and it's crying, and I'm praying for it to stop, it most of the time isn't selfish. Most of the time it is, I want that little being to be out of pain and out of distress. I want to give comfort. When I pray for something, I don't learn much about the sky, but I learn an awful lot about me and about what I care about, what I want, and what I'm willing to do. And remember, as Unitarian Universalists, service is our prayer. So in a lot of ways, prayer tells me where I need to focus not just my attention, but my actions. That song never fails to move me. I believe in its imagery, not in its literalness, but in its imagery. I don't have to believe literally every drop of rain that falls. If a drop of rain falls and a flower doesn't grow, is this a broken promise of all faiths? Of course not. We don't have to take this stuff as inerrant truth, but as poetic truth of the relationship of our relationship to the wonders of nature. This song was going through my head and through my heart when I stood by and watched the birth of my first son, Adam. And the whole idea of how love can become flesh and life and soul is miraculous. I can pretend that I understand it. I can go back to high school biology and maybe even freshman college biology and say, well, I know when the spermatozoa and the ovum really, really like each other and they get together and it's not just for the weekend, then you have this and you have the cytoplasts and you have the zygotes and you have all of this stuff and all that's great and I want to understand it and I want medicine and science to work and to advance. But sometimes, as I did in, yes, it was Berkeley, not in the 60s, but the 70s, and I was not stoned, but I stood by as he came out and just went, wow, how does that happen? And that's a theological question. It's a philosophical question as well as a scientific question. And it's answered both in our science and in our poetry and music and art. All of those things inform us. The Sunday after Adam's birth, January 28, 1972, I went to my congregation and I preached the most rambling, emotional, and inarticulate sermon of my life, at least up until today. There's still time. Because I was just gobsmacked with wonder, with the miracle of it all. And we don't have to lose the sense of the miracle. We don't have to have it drowned out by other things. We can have reason, we can have science, and we can also have poetry. We can also just be in that wow state, as they used to say again in the 60s, just high on life. But if you pay attention to life, it's got to make you high at least some of the time. The other song that touched me and informed me and continued to is seemingly another theological song with God right at the heart of it. But if you listen to the words carefully and you understand that it was written by Kurt Weill, it's really deist at most and puts us in our little corner of this universe and makes us wonder at creation and ourselves and our power. Before Lord God made the sea and the land, he held all the stars in the palm of his hands, and they flowed through his fingers like grains of sand, and one little star fell alone. And the Lord God hunted through the wide night air for that little lost star on the wind down there. And he stated and promised that he'd take special care so it didn't get lost again. Now a man don't mind if the sun don't shine and the clouds blow over and darken him, so long as the Lord God's watching over him, making sure how it all goes on. But I've been walking through the night and the day, till my eyes grow weary and my head turns gray. And sometimes it seems maybe God's gone away, forgetting that promise that we heard him say, and we're lost out here in the stars, little stars, big stars, blowing through the night, and we're lost out here in the stars. This was a song written in 1948, and I heard in the early 50s. And I guess the time and the context are important. This was written post-Holocaust, post-World War II. And the idea of fundamental abandonment, no less the question of the existence of a divinity, was on the minds of almost everybody in the West and in the East. What is the theology of the Shoah? What is the theology? Where was God when 20 million Russians died, when 6 million Jews died, when countless homosexuals and communists were wiped out in the Shoah? Where is God in all of the starvation in Asia and the plagues in Africa? The question about that theology is coded in this song. And we're lost out here in the stars, not helpless lost in the stars, but maybe despairing of any intervention other than through our own hearts and our own hands, despairing that somebody else would clean up our mess and make peace for us and rebuild nations and towns and the dignity of people and try to renew and to repair the damage that we have done to each other. Divine intervention, if it asks for the strength to do it, made sense to me. But this song seemed to acknowledge that it wasn't going to get done unless we participated in the healing of the world. This song, as it played over, drove me not to my knees in ordinary prayer, but it actually drove me to join with my friend Malcolm Brodwick to the Los Angeles Astronomical Society, where I wanted to explore the stars, to behold with wonder the creation out there of those magnificent solar systems and galaxies and the edges of the universe itself. I wanted to both understand and just be bathed in the infinity of it all, of suns and stars and worlds beyond our imagination, of speeds and times that are not comprehensible to me. And I was filled with wonder at all of these things. Back then, for you young people here, all 12 of you, but 12 is a good religious number, there was a time when our skies were darker. The stars have always been there, you know that, but they are not as visible today as they were 50, 60 years ago. And I would go to the mountains and look up at the stars at infinity and wonder at the power of all of this and understand my own tiny little spark right here on this infinitely small grain of sand rotating around an undistinguished star at the edge of a pretty normal galaxy in a constellation, and on we go. And I was interested in the science of it. Our Earth spins around, and for those of you who know that I'm a numerate, you have to understand that I'm going to look at the numbers, that our Earth spins around at about 1,000 miles an hour. It orbits the sun. Right now, we are traveling 1,000 miles an hour circularly on the planet, 67,000 miles an hour orbiting the sun, 45,000 leisure miles per hour is our solar system turning slowly within the great galaxy. And we are the Milky Way at a closing speed with the Andromeda galaxy of about 300,000 miles an hour. So 67,000 miles an hour, 47,000 miles an hour, 300. Is there any wonder that it sometimes feels that we're hanging on by our fingers here under the earth as it all spins so recklessly out of control? And do we give thanks that at all those speeds our hair ever stays in place and we look like normal human beings? All of these numbers, all of these things, all the science, all the wonder, they're not fighting with each other. They are when we stop and we can actually see the stars, or equally on the ocean if we are off in the ocean and subject to the sense of infinity that puts us in a place not humiliating, but with a certain kind of humility that puts our problems, our lives, our passions in some perspective. It doesn't make it all nonsense. It just puts it in subspecie eternitatis, in the light of eternity. Every moment is a gift. Every moment is precious. Every moment is a miracle. And it's important to see that miraculousness in our lives and of our lives themselves. As I watched my wife healing, it's miraculous. You see a scar start to disappear. You see strength starting to come back. Her hip replacement, even with the bump, the 30-hour bump, is science and poetry and life and miracle if you stop and think about it. When I was writing this and sitting out in my backyard on a November day when it was 80 degrees, and I'm sitting in my backyard and I'm looking at our four hibiscus flowering. When I stop to smell the flowers, I see them growing and changing, petals falling, becoming mulch for the next season, and feel a part of this miracle of life, this miracle of existence, that there is something when there doesn't have to be something, that of all the some things in the universe, some of it is alive and here and in this room and able to be together and able to think and act and help each other and sustain each other, to be candles to each other, to be lights that light and give light, lights that warm, to be present to each other, to see the divine spark in each other. Religion often tries, when it's not doing social governance, tries to remind us of the miraculous, tries to remind us, and I don't mean miraculous as the intervention. Look, I understand the argument from design. How could all of this have happened naturally? My God, someone must have designed it. If you wear a watch, that watch didn't assemble itself. Well, the argument against design is the spine, because a third-year engineering student would have done a better job. So forget the argument from design. It makes it more, not less, miraculous that we have evolved, that life, that existence sprang up out of nothing, that life and ensoulment and reason and passion can all live together for a while in each human being. Evolution does not attack that at all. It just that we are such a constellation of blood and hormones and electricity, and somehow an individual self-conscious mind with moral choices is created. And we have the power to recognize that and to recognize it not simply in ourselves, but importantly in each other. To me, that is just another one of those absolutely stoned wow moments, where I am just stoned on the realization of what life is and what an extraordinary, precious gift, the everyday miracles that we experience. I want to know how everything works, And I also want to be able to stand by every miracle and say, wow, to be attentive to it. The third work that touched me was Our Town. I got at a very young age to play the stage manager, or for those of a certain age, the Henry Fonda part. And it got me. It really got me. Emily, whom we meet as a young child, marries, grows up, marries, has a child, and then dies in childbirth. And after the funeral, the scene in Our Town is she's supposed to get up out of the grave and join the other dead and go off to eternity. But she says, I want to go back. I want to go back and visit. I want to go back and look. I want to go back and see. I want to go back and feel. And they try to tell her, no, don't do it. It's going to be too painful to leave again. It's just going to be too painful. But she's insistent. And she goes back and she picks a day in her 12th year. And she just walks through her kitchen, through her house, through that ordinary day in her life, and is washed over with the sheer poignancy. Not that because she was, but because she hadn't noticed, she hadn't paid attention, she hadn't savored the ordinary moments. And when she prepares, her day is ended, and she prepares to go to eternity, she says, goodbye. Goodbye, world. Goodbye, Grover's Corner, Mama and Papa. Goodbye to clocks ticking, and Mama's sunflowers, and food, and coffee, and new ironed dresses, and hot baths, and sleeping, and waking. Oh, Earth, you're too wonderful for anyone to realize you. Then she turns to the stage manager and says, does anyone ever realize life while they live it every minute? No. Saints and poets, maybe. They do sometimes. We don't have to be saints or poets to be touched by the poetry of existence, to be touched by the wonder of nature, to be inspired by the opportunities that we have during this time that we have now, to make a difference in the lives of the people whom we love, in the communities that we build and maintain and share, and with an ever wider appreciation of a world that we are not apart from, but we are a part of nature, life, the universe, and everything.